Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories and meeting the people behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. And every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations on air, bringing the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. Today, I'm really psyched to have Katie Cargiulo from Counterculture Coffee here. She happens to be the first New Yorker to ever be named a U.S. Barista Champion, which is a very big deal. We'll get to that. In the second segment, I'll be talking to Lisa Giffen, the executive chef of Maison Premier right in Williamsburg. And because I always can't quite believe we're out of time at the end of every Radio Cherry Bomb segment, the kind folks here at Heritage have given us an extra 15 minutes. So from now on, each show will run 45 minutes long, which is great. Katie, hi.
Hello.
I'm so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to spend most of our time today talking about what you're doing now with Counterculture, but I want to take a little step backwards just to begin. And I'm sure you've talked about it a ton, but I just want to congratulate you on air for your win 2 years ago.
Thanks so much.
It's really like huge. For anyone listening who might not know about the competition, is it safe to say that the U.S. Barista Championship is kind of like the Oscars of the espresso world?
Yes.
Is that accurate?
I think that's totally accurate.
From what I've read about it and heard about it, it sort of sounds like pretty insane and pretty difficult. So I guess when you're in it, you had 15 minutes to prepare. It's a round of espressos, cappuccinos, and a signature
beverage.
Yeah. And it's all set to music, whole routine?
Yep. Yeah. You play your own soundtrack. You have a microphone on. So in addition to making delicious beverages, you're expected to give a presentation to the judges that includes a lot of information just about your coffee and the reason why your drinks are going to taste the way that they drink, but also just sort of displays like passion and knowledge about coffee in general.
And you were up against how many other baristas?
I think there were 54 competitors.
Oh my God, wow. Wow.
That year, and then it gets whittled down into rounds, and this is sort of what makes it the Oscars too, is that there are six finalists, and so all of those people are immensely talented, and probably on any given day, any other person the points might fall out a little bit differently, but...
And are you
I had a lucky year?
Were you in these rounds? Are you doing the same routine for each one?
Yes, you're doing. You're preparing the routine. You have to bring all of your own dishware, and you bring some of your own equipment for brewing as well. So it's too much of an investment to prepare three different routines for three rounds.
Yeah.
You just do the same thing.
And how long did it take you to prepare your routine? When did
I worked on it for about 8 months. I definitely, I picked a coffee first, so I knew that I wanted to use coffees from Yirgacheffe, Ethiopia. Those coffees have a really exotic flavor profile, and Ethiopia is really close to many coffee people's hearts, because that's where coffee is indigenous to, is Ethiopia. Everywhere else that coffee grows in the world, that plant was sort of taken and brought there in different mutations, in different forms. So I knew that I wanted to tell the story of Ethiopian coffee today and what makes it the way that it is. And so I sort of worked on picking a way that I would present my espresso cappuccino and then thinking about a signature beverage and really trying to come up with language that connected each beverage to the next.
And can you tell everyone a little bit about your signature beverage?
Because
I read about it and it sounded sort of amazing, and the story you told about coffee by making that is, I think, incredible and worth sharing.
Thank you. Yeah, I love working on the signature beverage because it's a way to be creative, which, for a lot of people, coffee is just, it's just a beverage. Maybe espresso, cappuccino, cortado is as crazy as it gets. But, it can be used as an ingredient in a lot of different ways. And I find that challenge to be exciting. But when I was thinking about Ethiopian coffee and what makes it special, Ethiopian coffee for centuries was mainly just naturally processed, which means that you pick the coffee cherries off of the trees and then let the seeds that are inside, which eventually become the beans that we grind and drink, you just let them dry inside of the cherry, and it gives it like a very sort of heavy fruity flavor profile. As coffee moved around the world, that drying process wasn't really able to be replicated in other areas, and so they came up with a washed process, which is to immediately remove the seeds after you pick them, do some fermentation to make sure that the rest of the fruit sort of dries itself off and washes itself off, and then dry the seeds to prepare them for export. The way that they do it in Yirgacheffe starting in the 1950s was to ferment the coffee underwater before it would dry. And so you have these coffee seeds which are covered in fruit, and they're fermenting in water for 2 days. And so the water is fermenting too. It starts to take on the flavor of coffee cherries, which are like jasmine and a little bit of green tea. And then it also starts to take on the flavor of fermentation, which is sort of like carbonation and vinegar.
Is that water that's used to ferment it, is that product used for anything? Is that
consumed
or sold?
No, it has to be, especially for coffee to be organic, it has to be treated in a way before it can be sort of put back into the ground or into the rivers. But it's not a product that's used. They just sort of use water to do that. But I wanted to, because that process makes Ethiopian coffees taste a certain way, I wanted to use that as an inspiration. So try and recreate the flavor of that water at origin. And then, so that ended up being some nectarine and lemon mash that was sort of fermented for 48 hours in my refrigerator. And then
the hotel room before the competition.
Yep. And then some jasmine green tea and some sparkling water from a soda stream. And then ended up with 3 drops of white vinegar.
Wow.
Just because, as you guys know, in cooking, like vinegar can really be... it can really heighten a lot of other flavors up to a certain point, and then you get to that point, and then it's like, oh, this just tastes like vinegar. So I sort of experimented over time with how much.
Sort of amazing to think of it like as a dish that needs these sort of notes, and incredible the story you're able to tell with the drink of just like this whole process. And I mean, I never knew about any of that, and I think in so many food products that are part of our day-to-day lives, coffee, wine, chocolate, like it all comes down to these like nuances of like ways people preserve them or ship them or things that are included in them, and it's like these small little differences of like whether that's done underwater or not. So that's sort of amazing.
Yeah.
Are you still involved in the competition circuit? Is that still part of your life? Or?
Yeah, I usually go to the regional competitions in the U.S. I have helped some of my coworkers prepare as sort of a coach. And I've also sort of gotten into the emceeing of the competition I really like. I really like interviewing competitors and talking to them about...
So you're like John McEnroe now.
Yeah, basically.
That's so awesome. I think it's such an interesting part of the coffee world. And it almost sounds like a, you know, traveling like gymnastics or like the Olympics or something.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I want to go back a little bit further. I just want to know more about your background and where you're from and how does one become a barista champion? What was the road you went on?
Well, I grew up in New Hampshire. I went to college in Washington, D.C., and I wanted to get a job either at a bookstore or a coffee shop because I thought it would be cool. You know, like most people think. My favorite show when I was in high school was Felicity, so I definitely had a big love for thinking that working at a cafe in college would be great. So I started at Barnes & Noble. They hired me in the cafe. I was there for about 4 months, but I walked into a coffee shop in Georgetown around the corner and was sort of blown away by the sort of care that they were taking into the preparation of espresso, which we didn't take at that time at the cafe in Barnes & Noble. Sort of it was just like, you know, press a button and it comes out. So I applied for a job and got it. That was at a place called Murky Coffee. And that's where I got introduced to counterculture coffee. And that was the cafe that I worked for the next 5 years while I was in college. And I had the opportunity to participate in some barista competitions while I was in school, and also travel to some of the annual coffee shows and meet a lot of people in the industry, and sort of connected in my mind that there are a lot of different opportunities in coffee, including doing barista work and service stuff, which is interesting, but I was always definitely drawn to sort of education type stuff or roasting or, you know, the sort of the global coffee trade and the opportunities that it could present.
And that's primarily what you're doing now with Counterculture.
So 7 years ago, I moved to New York to work on the customer support team. Actually, I was the customer support team for Counterculture 7 years ago. And then sort of we've grown. We now have a training center in Soho, and I have six other co-workers, and we have over, you know, 100 accounts in the New York metro area. And basically, it's just my job to make sure that all of the coffee at our accounts, that people have the opportunity to learn about, you know, what makes it good, and specifically have the opportunity to learn how to brew it, because it's a big part.
And tell us a little bit more about Counterculture and who runs it, who started it.
One thing that we were started in 1995 in Durham, North Carolina, and that's still where our headquarters are. We're a wholesale-only company. So we source coffee from a number of different countries around the world, and we roast it, but we don't have any cafes ourselves. And what this has allowed us to do is really sort of focus on the sourcing part and also helping the people that buy our coffee do a good job with it. So instead of cafes, we have 8 training centers in different cities on the East Coast. And people at those training centers, and what we do is, those are basically the training centers for coffee shops that use our coffee. They can come in and use it however they like. And then we also will do sort of ad hoc trainings. We have a curriculum of classes that we teach that's more like, you know, in a training you learn how to do it. And in one of our counterintelligence classes, you learn why. You know, it's important to, you know, grind this way and tamp this way.
I want to take the counterintelligence course, the counterculture. Yeah, that sounds
cool.
Awesome.
And
And so are you teaching these courses, or what, how do you sort of, what's your day-to-day life?
Yeah, so we usually have 3 to 4 classes a week. We do have a full-time person in our office whose job it is to coordinate those classes. But we usually have at least one sort of instructor or assistant per 5 students. So I'm often an instructor or an assistant in a class. And then the other things that we do just for the public is that every Friday at 10, we have a tasting. We try and taste different coffees comparatively. So it's not just coming in and here's a coffee from El Salvador and this is why it's great. But, you know, here's a coffee from El Salvador and here's the same coffee from a farm, you know, 2 miles away, and let's talk about why they taste different. And sort of, so we have an open house every Friday, starts at 10, wraps up around 11.
And that's at the location in Soho. That's awesome.
It's actually at every training center for Counterculture. So we started that, I guess those tastings started in Durham a long time ago, and it was a way of staff education. So it was a way for the roasters, the people that bag coffee, the people that take orders, to just learn more about coffee in general and learn more about our product. And then they opened it to the public, and, you know, we were one of the first companies to do public tastings in that way, and they've been really successful, not only as a staff education tool, but also for the general public as well.
Are you able, in your role at Counterculture, to be involved at all in the sourcing of coffee or any of that travel that comes along with it?
Not totally. We have a team of people. There's 2 head buyers in Durham, Kim and Tim, and then there's a buyer's
Kim
agent,
and
Hannah.
Kim,
the
sound
office.
Like a band.
Yeah. So it's their job to... it's their job to travel. I mean, part of what they're doing is they're trying to create more transparency in our purchases by visiting and talking out, working out contracts. And they're also trying to work on getting better quality coffees for Counterculture. And it's not that they're going and they're tasting coffees and they're just picking the best ones and they're buying them. You know, we buy through partnerships and relationships. So they're visiting people that we work with and saying things like, you know, if you can guarantee this ripeness of picking and if you can do this style of fermentation and this drying, this is going to make the coffee taste better, and we will just pay this amount outright for you to do this stuff. Regardless of whether or not it works out that it actually tastes better, which it almost always does.
Yeah. Sort of like, I mean, in my head that translates to like if you're talking to someone who's cooking about maybe going to the farmer's market, buying something that's grown locally and it's growing in season. And like, not only does that have like environmental and ethical implications, it just, it tastes good.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
That's reason enough to do it.
Totally.
I'm kind of happy you brought up the idea of transparency in the coffee business because it's sort of notoriously, an industry that doesn't have a lot of transparency. What do you think, two questions, what do you think is like the most misunderstood thing about sort of coffee growing and selling, and also, and can you sort of turn that into what do you recommend people look for when they're buying coffee?
That's a good question. I think that there's a couple of things that are really misunderstood. Some roasters are reluctant to release the prices that they pay for coffees because there is a big disparity between the amount that you pay per pound, which at counterculture is somewhere between like $2 and $4, and the amount that the customer pays in a coffee shop per pound, which might be, you know, like $20 to $25. But there's a lot of steps in between sort of coffee growing and it getting to the customer, you know, the shipping that it takes to ship it from origin to the country, the roasting process, all of the packaging, all of that stuff. And so at Counterculture, we release a transparency report every year that gives the prices and sort of a general sort of update in all of our direct trade relationships. Yeah, but it we need to also sometimes give a lot of context because people get confused, you know, if you paid $2, why is this $18? And then I would say that for consumers, I mean, I think it's sort of like anything else. It's good to find out more about the companies and the brands that you want to buy from, and then you can just sort of trust them. It's not about like any one coffee, if that one coffee is, you know, certified organic, or if it's even necessarily has a direct trade certification. You should definitely look at the certification requirements for the different coffee companies that you want to buy coffee from.
And the report that, I mean, Counterculture being this company that really provides so much information and transparency, that report that you produce every year, is that available to
the public?
It's
on our website.
It's on the website.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. That's really, I think like any industry where the source of the product is coming from so many different places, the more you can know about it, the better. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, just the more stories you get to learn. And I know Counterculture provides a lot of that. And just a really educational, wonderful company. So
yeah, sometimes, I mean, we struggle with being too wordy, especially on our packaging. Like, not everybody cares, you know? So it's sort of finding that balancing act of providing the information for the people that want it, and also just, you know, being demystifying and being very simple, like, this coffee's going to taste this way, and it's going to be delicious.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, I'm sure a lot of customers are turning to you just because your coffee tastes
good.
Not just because you're doing all these great things, but, I mean,
exactly.
It's all serves, you know, serves the cup. Mm-hmm. Sort of funny, but I think really fascinating question. I want to know how you take your coffee.
Oh. Well, I normally drink brewed coffee black.
Do you make that at home? Where does that happen?
I make it at work a lot, and I go, you know, part of my job is going to cafes and drinking coffee, whether it's Counterculture Coffee or other people's, sort of seeing what's out there. So I'm really lucky that I usually get to go to a coffee shop in the morning, and I'm able to, you know, stay there and maybe catch up on email.
It's like literally
things of that
like
nature.
A job perk.
Yeah, it's an incredible job perk. But on the weekends, I make coffee at home, and I use a Kalita Wave. So I have a grinder. And I have an electric kettle that has like a gooseneck spout on it.
Sort of looks like a watering can.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's the one that I have can plug. There's a heating element that plugs right into the wall that heats it. So I don't even have to put it on the stove, which is nice. And then I have a scale. And those are like my three, you know, coffee brewing equipment.
And what kind of grinder do you have?
I have a Baratza Virtuoso grinder. It's really nice. I tend to make coffee one way at home for a month or two at a time because every coffee brewing process does require a slightly different grind. And I don't, you know, if I want to make coffee on the weekends, I don't want to have to make 6 cups to make it taste good. Mm. So, you know, for right now, I'm rocking the Kalita Wave. And then eventually I might switch to AeroPress or something else, and I might take some time to dial it in, but I'm not changing it day after day.
And how much coffee do you drink?
Probably about 2 to 3 cups. In the coffee business, we do a lot of spitting. But I would never go to a cafe and spit their coffee.
I'm glad to hear that. I think that's good.
I think that is, you know,
there's a lot of. I think there's a lot of interesting parallels between the coffee world and the wine world, and just the same kinds of tasting and sourcing. And there's, I mean, just a ton that's really similar.
Yeah.
These questions about how you take your coffee kind of lead me into the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire section, which are the questions we ask every guest at the end of their segment. So we're about at the time. So it's 8 questions, no pressure, totally relaxed. Number 1, sweet or salty?
Salty.
2, what did you have for breakfast today?
What did I have for breakfast today? I had a smoothie. I've been rocking a smoothie every day. It's been making me feel really healthy.
You have
a lot of
gadgets at home.
I have a lot of drink gadgets, to be honest. Like a lot of things to make beverages specifically. But yeah, I have one of those BlendTec blenders. A fun fact is that I won that at my first barista competition in 2004. That was the second place prize.
That's a good prize.
And the first place prize was a little home espresso machine. But I kind of felt like I had hit the jackpot with the blender.
That's
'cause I can go out for coffee anytime. But there's kale, blueberries, banana, yogurt, and flax seeds.
Healthy.
Yeah.
Number 3, what are you reading right now?
Oh, man. The latest issue of The New Yorker.
I think I'm on an issue from like 3 years ago. So you're doing better than me.
I need to pick up a book, but I haven't started any summer reading.
Number 4, if I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
Well, there's one more pizza dough left over that I couldn't find from my party on Saturday night.
Katie was telling me before we went on, she made, you know, we're here at Heritage, which is at Roberta's. She made Roberta's pizza for her birthday. So for 15 people at home, which was no joke.
I found it in the back, so it's hanging out so I can have a pizza anytime.
That sounds good. That leads into my next question, which is, what's your go-to snack?
Oh, I think my favorite snack, like indulgent snack, is nacho cheese Doritos.
Oh, delicious. Classic. But
my go-to snack is probably more on the nut variety, like some raw almonds or something like that.
I'd go for the Doritos. what is your favorite time of day?
Afternoon.
And where do you want to travel to next?
That's a great question. I really would like to go to Ethiopia. I don't know if that's next on the travel. I would like to go to San Francisco this summer, so maybe I'll say that.
That sounds a little closer. lastly, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Definitely lasagna. That was my, like, birthday. This is what I would like is a lasagna casserole.
Delicious.
Italian for life.
Katie, thank you so much for being here. We're going to take a quick break. I think I'm going to grab a coffee. And then we're going to be back with Lisa Giffen.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Yeah, you swore it'd be your love.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. We were just speaking with Katie Cargiulo, the U.S. barista champion, and now we're turning the microphone over to Lisa Giffen, the executive chef of Maison Premier in Williamsburg. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
I'm so happy you're here today. Maison Premier is one of my favorite spots. Your background is pretty fascinating. It sounds like it paved the way for all sorts of cultural influences in your cooking. Can you tell everyone a little bit about where you're from and where you grew up?
Yeah, well, I was born in Korea, but was adopted. My mother was 29 at the time, working for the U.S. government, and didn't think she was probably going to get married anytime soon or going to have children. So she decided she wanted to adopt children, and adopted my sister and I while she was out stationed out there. And then, funny enough, thinking that she wasn't going to get married, she met who I call my dad, like months later. So
life happened really quickly.
Yeah. So I was adopted. And then we moved to the United States for just a very brief period, probably till I was in the third grade. And then after that, we moved to Germany.
And how old were you when you were adopted, if you don't mind me asking?
I was 6 months old.
Okay. So pretty little. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you went to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And you were there for
11 years.
Wow.
And my parents were there for 15 years.
Wow.
There was a lot going on with what they were doing with the Gulf War and then the Bosnia conflict. So it really kept them there versus having to be stationed at other places like a lot of my friends growing up.
Mm-hmm. And then you came back to
the
States?
Then I came back to the United States to go to college. I was American, but I wasn't,
mm-hmm.
Because I spent my formative years somewhere else, but had American parents and still, did American traditions, but I wanted to be as American as possible when I went to college, even though I had, no background of what American kids did, Saved by the Bell, and Taco Bell. I didn't do any of that stuff, but I really wanted to be American as much as possible. So I chose a school in Arizona that kind of, embodied that kind of being in the United States, not something too avant-garde like New York or anything like that,
sort of all American.
Yeah.
Katie, who we were talking to earlier, was talking about watching Felicity and how that sort of influenced her career path in coffee, so I understand that sort of influence.
Didn't watch Felicity, but all those kind of shows I had to do a catch-up on the first year or two in college, because people would make references to that, and I was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I grew up in Germany, So, I'd spent a lot of nights watching reruns of The Golden Girls and Saved by the Bell, so I could laugh at the same jokes that everyone was talking
about. So you had extra pop culture homework. What did you study when you were a student?
Consumer studies.
Because you, I read that one of your first jobs was for one of my favorite products of all time that I use every day, which is Sharpie, markers. How did that job come about?
It was what every kid does when they leave college, they need a job, but they don't know, I wasn't necessarily eager to take a job, but I knew I needed a job. And they were doing a very big, heavy recruiting process on the campus. And it was a company that was hey, do you want to have a car? And do you want a phone? And do you want to travel? And I'm like, yeah. And you want to work for Sharpie Markers? Yeah. So why not?
And what was your job when you worked for them?
I basically did on a consumer level, not customer to customer, but on a consumer level, really spread the brand name. Mostly in the education sector, though.
That's so funny. Do you feel like that career had, or that experience had any influence on your career as a chef?
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time not liking the job.
Mm-hmm.
So it really fueled me to pursue the jobs or the passion that I wanted to. You know, sometimes when you really hate something, it's
it's just as valuable to know what you don't like to do.
Yeah. But I was able to eat out at a lot of places because of the job. And being in New York, moving to New York because of the job and being allowed to eat at all these places with no expense, whatever, it really was I really like this food and I really like this chef, and I had a lot more time to have because I worked from home. I didn't work in an office. So
it's sort
of moonlighted a lot of my former part of being a chef while I was working for Sharpie. So.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, so that was my next question. Because I'm always really curious about the moment when someone makes a real career leap, for example, going from Sharpie to working
Yeah, probably the worst employee at Sharpie.
And it's written in permanent marker.
Yeah, I was spending a lot of time in kitchens and then pretending I was working. And
So when did you... I can't believe I'm about to say this, but when did you really draw that line? When did you really become full-time
I was working
restaurants?
At Blue Hill.
Okay.
Well, working for free at Blue Hill. And one of the chefs I was working for, Juan Cuevas, worked there for many years. He had left. And I just, you know, like, it was exhausting to do two things at once. You know, like, to do a full-time job that I was being paid to do. And work in a very intense kitchen, which they required all of your energy and your passion. So I had to just make a choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did. I mean, I've been working in the kitchen like, you know, 30 to 40 hours a week and doing a
which
full-time
job. Which
is
extremely, extremely physical.
Yeah. So I just bite the bullet.
And you went for it. I want to talk a little bit more about this road that led to Maison Premier, where you are now, which is, we should add, it's a restaurant. I mean, you've really helped to change it. It's been a place that's been well-known and well-regarded since it opened, but primarily when it opened, it was just known for oysters and cocktails and absinthe. And now it's a place that's really known as a place where you can get a very, very wonderful meal. I think that's thanks to you. In my mind, the oysters are just the beginning now. It's not the whole story. But anyway, we'll get to Maison Premier in a second. But so your road to being the executive chef there, you worked at a bunch of places while you were working for Sharpie. But what was the time span between your first stage, which was, it wasn't at Blue, was it at
it was
Prune?
At Blue Hill.
And being an executive chef, how long did that take?
I would say like maybe 7 years.
And how long did it take while you were working at Sharpie to leave?
Probably 4 years.
Okay.
So I mean, you know, like once you decided to do it, you kind of realize, and I mean, I was like 25 at the time. You know, I think I was a lot more focused than maybe people of my age because I knew I was playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
So you become a little bit more focused and you become a little bit more like, I really want to learn from this person, not being like, I'm going to figure it out.
Yeah.
And like, I was like, I want to work for this chef because I'm inspired by this person. I want to learn as much as I can from this person.
And who are you talking about specifically? Who did you want to learn from?
From Juan Cuevas, mm-hmm. at Blue Hill. And he is very connected with like the Alain Ducasse group and that, you know, just working with a lot of people who have that background. It's not like you think about, oh, I want to be the executive chef. She's like, I want to learn as much as this person does.
Do you feel like there's still someone you would very much like to learn from at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, anybody I work with, you know. It's like, now that I'm in a different position, I see what it was like when I was, the cooks I have, I see what it was like, you know, when I was in that position.
Yeah, that was, I was going to ask, do you consider anyone sort of in your kitchen right now, do you feel like they're considering you a mentor at this point?
Yeah,
has that
I hope
table
so.
Turned a bit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I look at the things that they do and I said, you know, I've done this, like, you know, don't try to hide that type of thing because I was the one that did it. So I know when you're messing it up or I know if you, how this is going to be done because I spent a lot of my time just really focusing on learning instead of like, saying I want to be this person.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it eventually just kind of led me there.
Yeah.
Without me planning it.
Yeah. But it sounds like there was a lot of focus.
Yeah, I really liked that that discipline and that, you know, that drive that gets people who've been doing it for so long, when you have a question, they're like, this is how it's done or this is how you fix it. And it just, they know everything without like bragging about it.
I think all industries are based on like the exchange of information. And I think restaurants in particular, the kitchens and restaurants lend themselves to that so much because you're making tangible things every single day. So learning how to make them, how to explain that, how to keep it going, how to make the same over and over. I mean, it happens over and over. So when you're in the kitchen at Maison Premier, I want to know a little bit more about, your role there as the executive chef. How big of a kitchen is it? How many people are under you?
It's the kitchen itself. It's all electric. No, it's all induction burners. No gas or grills or anything like that. So it's all induction, which is a big learning curve I had to you know, deal with, because you spend 7 to 8 years learning how to cook on regular stoves, and then all of a sudden it's like, here, you're the executive chef. These are the type of stoves that we have.
Deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, there's a knob.
I like hearing, just before you came on air, you had lunch here at Roberta's, and you were telling me what you had, which was a fried oyster po' boy.
Right.
And it seemed like you were excited about it because you got to eat fried food, which you can't do at your restaurant because you don't have a fryer.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, it's funny to think about how your tools can influence your menu and what's possible, what's not possible. I liked reading, you did an interview with the Village Voice that I read earlier, and I liked hearing that you call yourself the everything girl, not the executive chef. How would you describe a typical day in your life? What are the responsibilities of an everything girl?
You know, since working at Maison Premier, like, it's a small company. It's not like, although we do a lot of volume and we have a lot of exposure, it's still, like, owned by just two guys, you know, like, who came from very humble beginnings. And so since being there, I've learned how to fix a walk-in, how to, like, reset the boiler, how to, you know, unclog a drain, out of the grease trap, or if something's leaking through the ceiling, what do you do? It's like all these things were just not something I thought I ever had to consider if I ever took that role, because I was focused on learning how to cook.
And I feel like the recurring theme when talking to anyone who works in or runs a restaurant is, like, you're basically dealing in, like, real estate, plumbing, and electrical, not the food business.
Weeks ago, I was, like, behind the ice machine, like, because it was, like, this big, and I was the only one who could fit back there.
Lisa's gesturing with her hands, and it's not a lot of space.
Yeah, like, back there, like, you know, like, trying to connect a hose and something, but, you know, it's real. It's like real things. It's like, I worked in such great grand houses that there was someone taking care of that. Like, it was almost as if, like, you didn't think that someone had to do, like, you just came in and you cooked and you made food beautiful and made everything great. And this is like real life. You know, like, if the dishwasher doesn't show up, what do you do?
The dishes you're still have
good,
to be washed.
You're too good to wash the dishes, you know? So I've washed dishes, I've shucked oysters, you know, I've gone behind the ice machine and, like, changed the hose and that. I've fixed the walk-in, defrosted things, like, things that I never thought I would have to ever know. And I think my dad would be proud, because I'm sure that's the kind of stuff he would want me to know.
Do you find it satisfying to know how to do all that stuff? And is that
a
position
in fact,
you want to be
in? I had
in?
A cook who left and became a sous chef somewhere else. And he texted me in the middle of the night and said, hey, what do? The walk-in is, like, frosting over behind the fan. And I text him back, like, so turn off the compressor. It's because I had done it already. I've already been through that process of staying up till 3 a.m. figuring out, like, what should I do if there's no emergency plumber or electrician to come in?
Chefs make great roommates.
You know, and if they're
everything.
Around.
Yeah. Even better. That's so funny. What item on your menu right now are you most excited about?
Right now, I have a menu item that I started featured last year, but I've brought it back this year just because I really loved it, and it was, like, one of the first dishes I ever was my own. Mm-hmm. It's an asparagus and morels and poached oysters. So beautiful morels from Oregon, like, and then wonderful, like, sauce with, like, Vinjon wine. And then it gets, you know, tossed with some oysters, usually something from, like, the Chesapeake area, because they're nice and plump and they take a while to cooking. And then cream, and then, you know, pepper, salt, and then it's spread over asparagus. And it's just,
it,
like,
sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it's, like, refreshing, but, like, decadent.
Yeah.
But
I like a spring dish that happens to sort of be rich and
really good. I mean, it's asparagus, you know, it's all very, I like that dish a lot.
That sounds great. And you guys are open for, if anyone wants to come visit, you're open every day?
Every day.
Starting at 4, is that right?
Starting at 4 Monday through Friday.
Okay.
That's when the happy hour is, 4 mm-hmm. to 7. And then on the weekends we do brunch, and we do a very shortened happy hour on the weekends, starting from 11 to 1.
And the happy hour is very happy there.
Yeah, there's a lot of oysters being shucked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, you guys do very well. It sounds easier than it is.
I mean every single oyster is, like, shucked to order. Nothing is, like, pre-done. And so when you get people who, when you put an ad out for oyster shuckers, it's not like, oh, I can shuck an oyster. It's like, okay, you can shuck an oyster, but how fast can you shuck an oyster when you've got, like, 5 to 6 to 8 tickets coming up with all 100 oysters on each ticket.
And there's competitions for that.
It's there like, is, yeah. yeah.
We've been talking a lot today about Katie won the barista competition, so I feel like next time I speak to you, I want to speak to you with the oyster shucker.
Yeah, I'm not the best oyster shucker, but you know, I know how to shuck an oyster, but since working at Maison Premier, I've become faster.
Yeah.
You know, because before it was just all about perfecting it and getting it just right and, you know, flipping it over. Now it's like, okay, I have like 700 of these that I have to do, so I got to do it fast.
It's real.
Yeah, it is real. Yeah. And those guys, like, really just, they go every day.
Yeah,
you know?
It's, like, yeah. No, I can speak from experience sitting at the bar at your restaurant. It's a really wonderful time, and everything is done with so much care, but it is done quickly. You guys are serving a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's a lot of
and
work.
And it's tiny, too. It's like,
no, and you do a fantastic job. I'm going to go into the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A,
okay.
Which are the 8 questions that we ask every guest who comes on the show. There will be no oyster shucking required, so no need to worry. Number 1, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Number 2, what did you have for breakfast today?
Coffee.
I should speak to Katie afterwards. Number 3, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book about, I don't know the name of it. It's Letters from Avis DeVoto to Julia Childs. It's their correspondence that they
had.
Yeah,
that's a beautiful book.
I just started. Yeah. It's actually really great.
Yeah. When people wrote letters. Fun time. Number 4, if I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
I like cottage cheese. I probably have like a spoonful or two every day. But not like a whole bowl, but I'll just have a snack.
That's actually question number 5, the next question. What's your go-to snack? Is it cottage cheese?
It would be potato chips. And sometimes I dip the potato chip in the cottage cheese.
Delicious. Delicious. Do you ever have cottage cheese with anything else on it? Or?
Yeah, I'll do a cottage cheese with olive oil and salt and pepper.
It's very 2014.
Extra virgin olive oil, you know. But I do like that. I mean, I'll just have a thing, and I always just like kind of eat from the jar, container.
But you're a savory cottage cheese person. You're
definitely
not like a pineapple.
No, not.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, you're sweet, not salty. No. Okay, I'm going on a big cottage cheese tangent. Anyway, what is your favorite time of day?
Probably like early afternoon, you know. I mean, I think when you don't work a 9-to-5 job, that's when people are at work, and that's when the streets are quiet, and that's when it's just kind of calm, and, you know, kids are in school or not getting out of school, so it's just like this, like, perfect calm of a day, you know, for, you know, because before and after that, it's hectic.
Yeah.
Going to work, people coming home from work or school or...
It's like when everyone else is in, you can be out.
Yeah.
Number 7, where do you want to travel to next?
I'd really love to travel to, like, you know, Turkey or Istanbul. Like, it's just, you know, I think just the culture there seems, like, really cool, and the food, and just a part of the world I've never visited before.
I would love to come eat at the restaurant after you take that trip. I think that would be really cool.
I would love you to come eat at the restaurant anytime, before
Thank
or after.
Last question. What was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Probably my mom used to make lasagna.
I was the same answer as Katie. That's so funny.
Lasagna, like, because you got the salad, and you got the garlic bread, and, you know, just... And then you would have it the next day, which was always really good.
Mm.
But I really liked lasagna growing up.
Yeah.
My mom made a
good
lasagna.
So funny. It's lasagna day on Radio Cherry Bomb. Lisa, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
For listeners who live in or near Brooklyn, Maison Premier is at 298 Bedford Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And Katie Cargiulo, who we were speaking to earlier, can be found at counterculturecoffee.com, where all their information lives. And thank you to everyone who listened today. Tune in next Wednesday at 2 o'clock on Heritage for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.